I'm going to speak to us about Ken Fry, breeding with wild species to increase nutritional value of oats. With thanks to my co-preparers, Dr. Moldenhauer at University of Arkansas in Stuttgart and Stan Cox from the Land Institute. Now, Ken Fry, as it happened, trained as a corn breeder under George Sprague, and we've just heard about George Sprague's work, and so we have an understanding of what kind of an education he would have received. And we know that corn is a crop with great scope for breeding, both in the public and private sector. But oats is a very different story. For millennia, oats have been an important crop in temperate regions, both in volume needed on the market and on the farm. But then suddenly, in less than 50 years, less than a generation, draft animals were replaced by tractors. And suddenly, the market value of the oat crop no longer matched their farming system's value. If oats were to stay in the rotation, a new source of commercial value was needed. And exploration of new value for oats would have to be a public sector role. The goal of Fry's first job at Michigan State was oats that would corner the market as a nutritious feed for hogs. But a few years later, by the time he arrived at Iowa State, he was looking beyond pigs to people. And he was thinking of humans as the next big market for oats, which would be more likely with increases in nutritional value. His approach to increasing nutritional value of oats was probably influenced by his early career in corn breeding, with its emphasis on recurrent selection for quantitative traits. It was perhaps a form of conceptual hybrid vigor between recurrent selection concepts, which he would have learned through Dr. Sprague, and concepts of introgression, which were developed through Vavilov, who Fry did not know, but which he would have learned through Jack Harlan, whom he did know. As the result, Fry was one of the earliest to think about breeding with wild species as sources of variation for quantitative traits. His interest led Fry and his students in ever-intriguing exploration of the use of wild germplasm from related species, breeding methods for improving performance and variation in an inbreeding crop, for both quantitative as well as single-gene traits. Fry worked on several groups of traits, including multilines for disease resistance, performance in suboptimal environments, and nutritional value. His research made it clear that wild oats, Avena sterilis in this case, possessed quantitative genes of positive effect that are not present in cultivated oats, Avena sativa, and that these can be bred from Avena sterilis wild oat accessions that are not themselves necessarily superior for the traits of interest. And by the way, can you all hear me all right? Okay. Afraid I'm going to have to skip some of this to keep us moving and move on to the example of selection for high growth oil, which was a good example for how Fry put interspecific populations together. He used 28 parent lines, 26 parents for the target trait of high growth oil, and 12 parents to maintain agronomic traits, including yield. And you can see there, you don't have to read all the fine print for the numbers, I'm sorry, but you can see that he's got 8 Avena sterilis plant introductions from our National Plant Germplasm System from all over the world, and then 8 Avena sativa cultivated oats chosen also for high oil contents, and then 2 agronomic groups. Two groups of Avena sativa for agronomic performance. And in order to combine these parents into an introgressed gene pool that he could use as a base population, Fry used multiple matings, each one consisting of multiple crosses. And that first mating there in the first box on the left, he called it mating 1, but it was really 1A and 1B, the first being mating the high oil wild and cultivated lines, the sativa and sterilis, and then mating those to high oil sativa. And then, as you can see, he did a mild selection to keep enough agronomic type that you could conceive of growing those things in a field in Iowa. The second mating was no new parents, simply to recombine again those selections. Second, and again a mild selection, and then it wasn't until the third mating that he introduced group 2 over there on the right, the additional Avena sativa cultivars that had been selected for agronomic performance. Those were intermated once and then intermated yet again to recombine before he got to where he thought he had a gene pool that he could start working with. The result of all that was a base population having two sets of quantitative traits, high oil from sterilescent sativa and environmental adaptation from sativa. These had been recombined in steps with constant mild selection. Recurrent selection on that base population led to increases in groat oil content each cycle from about 8% at first to about 18% by cycle 9. This demonstrated that groat oil content genes in Avena sterilis are different from Avena sativa. The genes in the wild species are different from the genes in the cultivated species for high groat oil, and they're complementary. In terms of yield, which of course is also important, it went up through cycle 3, then it declined through cycle 7. But then by cycle 7 it started to go up and kept going through cycle 9, which was the last line that this population was carried through. Similarly, for protein content in oat groats, the starting point was about 17% in high yield oats, up to about 20% in high protein oil lines. Fry found that crosses of high protein Avena sativa parents with hybrid parents that were high protein interspecific crosses between sativa and sterilis, those tended to have a greater frequency of high protein progeny than when both parents were high protein sativa, demonstrating again distinct alleles in the two species. And as a result, his oat protein research always used intergressed Avena sterilis germplasm. Recurrent selection in those populations was able to achieve simultaneous increases in both protein and yield compared to the sativa chest, the cultivated chest. Even after he retired, Fry continued to be alert to developments for increased value of the outcrops, particularly in nutritional research. When it was established that beta-glucans can lower serum cholesterol in humans, he got to work assessing the range in oat groats and identifying a high-throughput screening method, which you always use, then intermated 20 high beta-glucan sativa lines into a base population, three cycles, three generations of random mating, and then selection again, which brought that population up to the highest known beta-glucan levels that were known in oats at that time. He then crossed that to 10 more unadapted parents, both unadapted sativa and wild sterilis, and selection was able to get the beta-glucan up to 50% above anything previously known. However, as you may have noticed, the result is not that oats are grown again in the Iowa rotation, but that they're grown in Canada. So there's still work to be done, and South Dakota State has recently started a new oat breeding program. I don't think their breeder was with us this week, unfortunately, but I hope we can encourage her with this to keep trying. One thing he did notice here was that increased drought increased beta-glucan level. Fry would have been interested in that because he was always interested in breeding for low input or suboptimal environments. Fry would have been very interested in the talks at this meeting this year. For example, Dr. Edmead's talk on Monday, and also some of the talks by Gary Atkins, some of the comments by Gary about breeding for difficult environments. And Gary was a Fry grad student, and it would be interesting to ask him how he and Fry got together on that topic of breeding for performance in low input environments. If you happen to see Dr. Atkins, you might ask him that. Good conversation over a glass of beer, perhaps. Is this the right place? No, I have gone one too far. All right. Our organizers asked us to talk about the impact on the next generation of breeders, and in fact, it has been said that students were Fry's main crop. His interest in exploring these different approaches to breeding an inbred crop were always intriguing to students, and in particular, his efforts to move quantitative traits, such as nutritional value traits, from an unadapted wild background into cultivars. And one side effect with that was that for many years, Fry had more close contacts in plant breeding in the U.S. than probably any other person. And an outcome of that was the 1994 U.S. National Plant Breeding Study. This was a summary of resources in both public and private breeding at the time. Fry was probably the only person who could have obtained the response he did, which was 100% from the public sector and 97.5% from the private sector. The National Plant Breeding Study was comprehensive data collected at a time when plant breeding was fully mature after a century of development. It showed a decline in plant breeding investment at the state ag experiment stations, but during the same interval, an increase in private sector investment. He observed that many of the crops that lacked adequate investment to make them of value to farmers and consumers were, and that was because there simply wasn't a way for a private sector to make an enterprise out of them, not enough profit to be viable. In a workshop that followed, recommendations were made to develop public support for investment in plant breeding beyond the major commodities, broadening the genetic base of crops for germplasm enhancement, and new crops, breeding and developing new crops. The workshop group also gave attention to integration, or encouraged public attention to integration of genomics and biotech, but look why specifically to find easier ways to add diversity and to speed up cycles. The group also recommended attention to future capacity, educating and training young breeders, and public-private interfaces in plant breeding. Amongst the early results of the National Plant Breeding Study, and I apologize for putting the wrong acronym there, NPBS, the single consensus that was reached by USDA's first advisory committee on biotech was on the importance of plant breeding in any agricultural framework. That was based on a conversation between Fry and the committee that was initiated by James Cook, the chair of that committee, who invited Fry to come and talk to them. And their report recommending that to the Secretary of Agriculture was, however, delivered 1 month before the attack on the World Trade Tower. So we won't know what would have come if that attention had not been diverted, and you wonder what else was going on in our nation that was diverted at that moment as well. However, Fry's call for healthy national plant breeding capacity was taken up by several workshops that followed and by several groups that are active now, each one different, as you can see there, and also by additional studies. And one thing I'd like to add to the slide that didn't get on there in time, the Plant Breeding Coordinating Committee, which is one of the offsprings of or descendants of Fry's study, is preparing a second, or a reiteration now, of a national study. And it will be led by the apple breeder who was mentioned in the talk in the last session, in Aaron Carter's talk on high-throughput phenotyping. So there's a constant linkage. And the impact of this part of Fry's work has been a broad national awareness of the importance of data and public discussion about our national plant breeding investment and activity. And it's hard to believe, but this really didn't exist before. Perhaps it was the glow of the Green Revolution, or perhaps just because plant breeders are busy. And if I have a moment, I won't go through all these acknowledgments, but I will point out a photograph of Fry himself kneeling on the ground in the front there, in a photo on a beautiful summer's day in 1979. The Oak crew, in fact, included many more people than are in the photo, both at that time in 79 there were more, and also before and after. I'd like to thank Jules Janik, whom some of you may know, the editor of Plant Breeding Review, for suggesting the original review article on Fry, from which much of this was taken, and also thank Larry Robertson, who compiled the list of Fry's publications. Thank you to Seth Murray and to Mary Gutierrez, who invited this talk. And we thought it would be easy. We thought we would just summarize the 2011 review. But in fact, we learned a lot about Fry's work as we reviewed it in the context of this year's crop science meeting. And I hope that we all did. Thank you.